Welcome everyone to Good Areas Live. We've got a podcast today about something that happened recently, which I found really interesting at the time, which was Ben Stokes coming out and saying that the English press had a vendetta against Ollie Pope, which of course surprised me quite a lot for a few different reasons, which is why I want to talk about it. The first one is, of course, that Ollie Pope is just the weirdest person to have a vendetta against. Like, I think I met him once or twice. He seems like a nice, normal human being who plays cricket. He's not like Ben Duckett, who's out in the media saying things. He's not like Zach Crawley, who seems to polarize or anything like that. Like, but Ollie Pope just exists. And so to have a vendetta against him, and if I remember the thing, and I think I did a short video on this on Instagram the other day, but if I remember correctly, I think I had left before the press conference happened. So I heard the original one, which might have been on Sky. And then he went in and was asked about the vendetta and he changed it to an agenda. So I just want to talk about the whole thing because I find it very interesting. The first is that he used the word vendetta and he's probably right. I would say he was potentially pulled aside by Danny Rubin or someone else in the ECB to be like, not sure that's the right word. Vendetta is a blood feud in which the family of a murdered person seeks vengeance or the murderer on the murderer or the murderer's family. I think we can say uncontroversially that Ben Stokes, that the English press does not have a blood feud going with Ollie Pope or Ollie Pope's family. I'm just going to put that out there. I think we're all aware of that. We're all quite comfortable with where that is at the moment. But what's more fascinating is the agenda, which is a secret aim or reason for doing something. I had to Google these to make sure that I got them correct. So let's just leave the meanings of those two things there for a moment and say that Ben Stokes probably misspoke the first one. He's, you know, maybe a little bit annoyed trying to back up his player, more than fine. And the second one is probably more of what he was actually probably thinking. We've all misspoke before and he cleaned it up really, really quickly. But I've been there when the English media have had a agenda against someone, and that was Kevin Peterson. I think it was pretty clear that Kevin Peterson had annoyed a lot of the press. I was in a lot press conferences back from when would I have started, from 2010, before that, from 2008 through to 2014, 2015, whenever it was he played his last game, 2014. And there was a lot of animosity. He would say really rude things to people in press conferences. I've been there when he said really rude things about writers and people in the press, including myself one time. I've also been on the other side of it and you know, I've worked with KP and, you know, I think when we were doing Death of a Gentleman, he was one of the easier people to organize an interview with. He wanted to do it and he said yes and he was where he needed to be. And I remember at the time that we had an issue with technology or something and he just waited an extra 10 minutes without any issue. And then he got asked the worst question by one of our producers who had never asked questions before but had something on his mind he wanted KP to answer and couldn't get it out. KP still sort of handled the question very well. So I've seen both sides of it. But I remember, obviously, during that period of which, you know, it's not easy being me in the change room and everything else, the English press were very much against Kevin Peterson. And I can tell you this story. And as I said, I've already been pretty fair with saying that, you know, there was an issue with me and KP when I was a player, he said some things in front of me that he just didn't need to say. And it weren't correct. He was just angry at other people and I happened to be within earshot. But when I started writing the piece about the way, the full backstory of it would be that I was privy to some of the stuff that was going on inside the English change room about how they were handling Kevin Peterson. I put air quotes on there in case you're listening to the audio version. And everything that they told me was either bullying or trying to cut him off at the knees, right? It's depending on how you look at it. And people will talk about this in change rooms all the time. Oh, you have a bad person in there. You need to cut them down to size and everything else. The issue with that is, and which was what I was trying to explain to these people involved with the change room at that time, is eventually that goes in two ways. Either you actually completely cut the confidence of the person, and so then they don't make any runs anyway, so you don't actually win, or they explode in the other way. And I assumed that KP would be the sort of person who would explode in the other way, which is what eventually happened. Every time he speaks up, someone has to go to him. You know, I think it's quite well known that there are certain people who really wanted to sort of bring him back down to earth. And he is a hard to manage person. Like anyone who's ever had to deal with him for a long period of time will know that, you know, KP sees the world in a very, very different way to other people. He can be very black and white with things. He doesn't always really understand context. He doesn't always understand someone could do something in a different way. And so there's always these issues that come up, right? The KL role of recent times, you know, and so you see these sorts of things happen. But if your only way of managing that, and this is what it was told to me before it came out in the press, was by basically abusing him every time he said something that was against the spirit of the change room, you're going to just put him into a corner until he explodes. And that is what happened. So that was the piece I kind of wrote when everything started to happen with the Monet Monkel WhatsApp, and not WhatsApp, direct messages, the Duist comments, whatever you want to say, all these different things that happened when the peak KP implosion or explosion happened. So I wrote a piece about all these sorts of things and about, you know, how he's obviously hard to handle. And I can't remember the exact word I used, but I think dickhead or wanker or something along those lines was in, you know, maybe arsehole. It was something like that I wrote. Like, I was pretty honest with the fact that multiple people in cricket had said that, and people I had trusted and had really good relationships with. So I had to accept that KP was a bit like that. But then I went through in the article going, but if you just keep cutting down this particular person, you're going to end up. And I explained what I just explained there. So I remember coming into the Lord's press box the day after, and it's very rare I ever got any feedback from people. In fact, in those days, they were kind of still a bit weird about Cricinfo, and they would go out of their way to pretend like they hadn't read your column, despite the fact that anytime you were in the press box between, you know, 2008 and 2017, like, the vast majority of people were on Cricinfo, but somehow they kept missing our articles or our videos, even with the autoplays. But this day, I remember coming in, and the first thing I was told was, oh, here's the KP apologist. And I remember it was a writer from The Independent, and Stephen Brinkley, who no longer works for them. And I went, oh, KP, Brinks, I didn't know that you had read my article. You know, I didn't know that you read my stuff. And he said, well, I haven't. And I was like, well, then how do you even know that I'm a KP apologist, right? Which, of course, took the wind out of his sails a little bit. But it showed you that if he hadn't read it, and I'm going to assume he hadn't, it'd be a weird thing to lie about, that there was already a conversation about that to begin with. And I'm thinking, so now, this article where I've been quite strident on both sides, like I could see how KP had been in the wrong and how England had been in the wrong, but that wasn't how it was being played. So I then go on the BBC later that day, and Jonathan Agnew says a similar thing. Jared, we've got you here as the KP apologist. And I was like, and I think I read out the opening paragraph going, it doesn't sound like I'm apologizing for him here, but it shows you just how much people had turned on KP within the media at that stage. And I'm always been a bit of a weird one within the UK media, because obviously I'm an Australian cricket journalist, but also I cover quite often the opposition teams, not England, right? Like, my general job has never been a day-to-day covering of the English team, whereas almost everyone else that I work with or I work around, that's their job. So I have opinions on English cricket, but my opinions on English cricket are more from a worldview, right? Whereas that's not what the vast majority of people I work with on a daily basis are. They are English specialists. Like, when I work for TalkSport, I'm working with English people, right? Back in the old days when I used to do, you know, some TMS stuff and some BBC stuff, exactly the same thing, but people who cover England, and that is their main thing. And so I'm used to my opinions being different. But it also allows me to be the outsider within the press box at times, right? Because I don't come into it. So to explain how cricket press conferences work, quite often a captain will say something and quite a few of the journalists will get together and be like, the line is this. And from the start, I was like, why would I want to know what other people think the line is? It's like, it's up to me to work out what the news is from this, or the story is from this, or what my article is going to be. And I always found that really interesting, that all these newspapers were kind of colluding on what the angle was. Didn't mean there wasn't ever dissenters, but it tells you what they were and kind of my relationship and how separate I was to start. So you have this situation with KP where there is no doubt that it was not a vendetta, but it was certainly an agenda. And I do think a lot of people within the media had had enough of him. He'd had a go at a few people. He'd had a go at them publicly. I think of John Etheridge. Can't remember if Paul Newman was one of them. John Etheridge and George Dobell are two people I'm pretty sure he took to Twitter to, you know, rubbish some of their stories. So, you know, there was more animosity at times than there needed to be because of that. You know, rather than just going up and going, are you sure this is right? Or where did you get this information? Because blah, which is how it's normally handled. He made it into a bigger thing because that's what KP does. That was an agenda. And you come back to Ollie Pope, and you look at Ollie Pope and you're like, Ollie Pope is just, as I said before, not that kind of guy, right? I can't think of anyone who's ever said anything about Ollie Pope being, maybe occasionally there's been talk about him having a slight big head when he was like in 2020 making all those runs against South Africa before COVID. But I don't, I'm stretching to even remember that if that was the case, right? You know, in Surrey, Sam Curran is the big guy, right? And, you know, in England, there's always been, you know, Ben Stokes or Joe Root. Like, I don't remember Ollie Pope. I can't think of any press ever coming to me and go, oh, that Ollie Pope, he's had it too good for too long, or he's a bit of a problem, or he gives bad interviews, or he's being abusive, or he's trolling us on social media or whatever. Like, I don't remember that happening at all. And I don't think I've ever had a conversation with an English media member where they've said anything about Ollie Pope that isn't directly related to his batting, which should be exactly what England want, right? Like, if you're a cricket team, that's what you want. You want to be judged on your cricket. You might say, oh, they're being a little bit negative because they want this and we're trying to play in this way. That's fine. That's a difference of opinion. But to think that there is an agenda against Ollie Pope, I think is a really interesting one. And I just want to go through his record a little bit here. So one of the things that Stokes mentioned was that Ollie Pope now averages more than 40 at number three. And the minute I heard that, I was just like, oh, there's some root mass on this. I love this. For those who don't know what root mass is, it was brought up years ago. Oh my God, I've forgotten it. Is it Dan who came up with it? I think it was Dan who came up with it, wasn't it? On Twitter. And it's basically that one stage, I think Root had made a lot of runs at Lords or somewhere weird. And so Root and people were taking those numbers out when they were looking at his record going, maybe he's not as good as we think. We complete opposite of me who watched him make 60 odd at Nagpur and went, this guy's going to play for the next decade and wherever he wants to bat. I went way too early on Root. I was right, but I still went way too early. But yeah, and so it's really interesting. If you look at Ollie Pope's career, he's now, and Stokes is right, after 28 matches of 48 innings, he has an average of 43 batting at first drop. Of course, his overall record is far lower than that. It's 35.49. And a lot of that is dragged down by him batting at number six. Now, I've talked to people inside the English camp. I've talked to people, former players. I've talked to professionals from other countries. No one thinks Ollie Pope's a number three. Most people think he probably should have been a number four or number five. And most people would say a number five. There's some issues with that as well, because I don't think he's a very good starter against spin. And so maybe number three might actually help him, because if he's in when he faces spin, he's a lot better. When he goes to face it fresh to the crease, he really looks out of his depth. So it might be that we're all misjudging him a little bit, and actually he is a number three. But the point being is that the two positions he's batted the most are first drop is the hardest of the non-opening positions, and fourth drop is the easiest of the non-opening positions, right? And yet he really struggled when he was down the order at number six. And when he's batted at first drop, he's ended up with an average of 43. Now, you can break that up by teams and by situations. And one of the more interesting things that you will see here is when he batted at number six, he had 100 and 550s. And when he's batted at first drop, he's got 700s and 750s. And he quite often goes on to get big scores as well. So it could be that he got an equal amount of starts at number six that he did at number three, but he's managed to go on and really smash them a few times at number three. You'd have to do a deeper analysis, but that's kind of a different point that I'm making. I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I've been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about batting. Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting. The point that I would be making is that Ben Stokes is purposely not mentioning that he's averaging 35.5, to tell the better story. That's an agenda, right? Like, that's an agenda as well. And it's fine that he has a pro Ollie Pope agenda, right? But when he's saying that everyone else has an anti Ollie Pope agenda, we have to understand that he's given a number that makes Ollie Pope look at his absolute best. I would argue that there are plenty of other numbers that you could pick that make Ollie Pope really look like a poor international cricketer. I think 35.49 is poor, but if you compare it to a lot of other cricket, like if you look compare it to, you know, Virat Kohli, Ajinkya Rahane, David Warner, I'm trying to think of some others, but Dean Elgar towards the end of his time as well. I'm trying to think of what else. There's someone else I've seen. Oh, and all the England batters. I don't think 35.49, I'm going to round that up to 35.5 now, is particularly terrible. It's not good, but it's not terrible. We've seen a lot of people struggle to get that those numbers in the period of time in which Ollie Pope has played. Remember, Ollie Pope starts his career at the start of the wobble ball era, right? I still think there are questions to be asked, but it's not a horrendous number. But when you break it down, there are some things that are huge questions. For instance, the average is less than 30 in New Zealand, India, Pakistan, right? And Australia combined. And it's way, I think it's way less than 30 as well. In Australia, he averages 11, right? And Aniket has just said in the comments, I think this is really interesting here, that 35 is the new 45. And I think there is an argument for that, right? I do think that you have to take that a little bit, right? But when you break it down to the places I just talked about, when he's going to the countries that are at their toughest, he's not even getting near 35, right? Like, so even if you were to say he's averaging more than 40, batting at number three, you also have to go completely the other way, and talk about these sorts of things, right, as well, and be like, yes, he has averaged more than 40, but he struggled the other way. Now, Ben Stokes isn't going to do that, right? But that's also the job of the English press. And I think the way that specifically the English press, but I would say most cricket press works this way, is that we focus on the next player going out more than anything else. That's not the case with sports that have substitutions, because in a sport that has a substitution, you don't have 5 days of that player failing, right? Let's take the example of Cook in the last test match. Let's say Cook plays quite poorly and he's not bowling the way they want. They're like, okay, well, let's just take him off and replace it with someone else who might be doing better on this kind of surface, or, you know, might fresh legs to come on and do that. You don't have that in a test match. So what happens in cricket is we get really, really fixated with that. And that breeds into the players. So I've had so many interviews with former players where they're just like, you have no idea how negative the press was. They hated me, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, it's just not how it works, because I've got friends on both sides and I've seen how the sausage is made. It's generally to do with this weird quirk of cricket and the way that people think about cricket. And so you do end up with, if you think about the English cricket team, it would be, the conversations would be over what? I'm trying to think of how long this would be. Probably since Rory Burns went, but I might be missing. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else I'm missing here. Oh, Bairstow might have been involved in this as well. But basically, it would be Pope or Crawley who are going to be dropped next. And so you're just going to cycle through which were either one. And both of them have gone through some really bad phases. Both of them have not made runs, you know, in some crucial series. And they both had some really great times, you know, Pope's innings in against India, Crawley, the last Ashes series. They've had some great moments as well, but they've also had the opposite. And so you end up in this thing where the news cycle, such as it is, covers the next player who's going to go out. So it ends up just going around and around in circles, right? And so with that, that's kind of what we're talking about here, right? That's what the players are getting upset about. That is actually just the way that cricket is set up. And you can argue that cricket writing and sports media in general should be better. And no one's arguing that more. One of the reasons I became a cricket writer was because I didn't think the game was particularly well written about. And one of the reasons I think I found it so easy to break in is because I didn't do the thing that everyone else did. I'm much less interested in who's going to get dropped. If you go through my career's work, you'll see that it doesn't come up all that often with me. And I'm not saying that I'm like a genius, because I only worked this out later in my career. It was a conversation with Lawrence Booth where it really came about. But I just never did it naturally, because I like to talk about the game and the reason these things have happened. And I'm not trying to do news. It probably is more newsy who is the player who's next likely to be dropped. So I do think there is a big element of that, right? On top of all that, one other thing that I really want to talk about with Pope is the fact that he's opened the batting, and that was just once. So I'm going to assume that could have been an injury or anything else. That was last year. But he's batted at 328 time in 28 matches. He's batted at 4 and 5. He's batted at number 5 position 8 times in number 6, 16 games, and at number 7, 4 times. So he's basically batted everywhere from 3 to 7. So a lot of changes. Then He's been captain four times, right? He's also been vice captain. He's also been the vice captain when he probably is going to be the player who is next dropped. On top of all that, I think when the Bazball thing happened, you have to credit him. He's not the most attacking player. He's not one of the players that McCullum was looking to make into a future England player. As in, he's not the most attacking player. I'll just have a look. I've got all of his stats here. I forgot to look up his List A stats. So he averages 33 in List A cricket at a strike rate of 79. So down on average and down on strike rate from someone who would be a very good player. And in T20 cricket, he averages 27 and a strike rate 131. So those are not particularly inspiring numbers, right? And a lot of the Bazball thing was taking players who were really good at white ball cricket, using those skills to come across to use them in red ball cricket. How much credit does Ollie Pope have to get for the fact that he has managed to play incredible Bazball innings at times? You know, what was like against Zimbabwe when he came in the other day and he was just stroking the ball around everywhere. There was no reason to commit to that bid at that point. It didn't matter all that much. And there are other players for England who came in and knocked it around more than he did. He went for it. And we've seen it again and again, taking huge risks sometimes. And I think he has to as well, because he does have a limited game. So we see him, you know, charging down the wicket more often than other players. And I think if you just bowl at the top of the off stump, you have trouble. He has trouble. He has to take more risks with a reverse sweep, especially early on in his innings, because he doesn't play spin as well as other players. You know, all these sorts of things. But you have to give him credit for that, because I think, you know, the way that I look at a player is he was put in a situation where realistically England were probably wondering whether he was the player for the future. And I'm just having a look since in that sort of Bazball era. It's not as if he's been averaging 50 in any of these years, but he averaged 37 in 2022, which we've said before is not terrible, but it's okay. He played 5 tests the next year and averaged 45, and he played 17 tests. God, so many people played so many teams a while back, but he played 17 tests in 2024 and he averaged 33. That's the reason he's back in the sights of the media. It's not about agendas. It's not about vendettas. It's not about Ollie Pope's personality. He's back in the spotlight because in 2024, and for no fault of his own, as I said before, in 2024, he was already playing in multiple different positions. He made 300s, the incredible one in Hyderabad, and then obviously struggled after that. He made the 100 in Nottingham, and then I'm trying to remember where the other one was. Oh, the other one was versus Sri Lanka, right? He probably should have made more runs last year. He certainly should have made more runs as a number three and as a vice captain and everything else within the side. But he didn't. And so it is the media's job to have a look at that. Do I think the system that the media use is correct? No. Do I think all cricket writing could change from people talking more about cricket and less about news? Of course. Like, I just think in this modern day, I'm not even sure why news articles are your go-to anymore. That doesn't seem to me the way that the internet works anymore. So I would probably move on from that as well. But do I understand why Ollie Pope is being questioned by the English media? Of course. And I say that as an analyst. I would say that if I was working for the England team. Like, you look at this and you think to yourself, this is a person who is not making as many runs, who is now, 7 years into his career? What would Ollie Pope's age be? You would have thought I would have had that before here as well. I probably did. No, he's 27. If you're averaging 33 in your, what would that have been, his age 26, 27 year, with the amount of experience that he's had behind him, with the leadership potential that England obviously think he has, I think it's fair to say that's not a great year and that he still hasn't quite nailed that position. There's also this incredible hubbub around Jacob Bethel and everything else. You know, there's some other younger players coming through that might also start to rattle that. I don't think there is any problem with asking questions about Ollie Pope. There's certainly not an agenda. There's certainly not a vendetta. If there is anything, it's a cycle and it's going on forever. And I think cricketers need to understand better how the media works. And that comes down to how they are trained by their boards, right? And me and Robbie talked about this in a recent podcast of a lot of cricketers just don't understand what the media is and how it actually works. There are times when there are real agendas. You know, we talked about it with KP. There's quite often you will get local journalists who will all sort of band together. If there's a local writer local player making a lot of runs and they're in first-class cricket and someone at an international level, not from their area, not making runs. There's all that sort of, there are like micro versions of that. But generally what it does is it just follows one player. And so it's that, you know, it's Ishan Sharma, it's Kyle Rahul, it's Ajinkya Rahane, it's Marcus North, it's Ollie Pope, it's Zach Frawley, right? There's always a player that is not quite in that, you know, not quite in the automatic list. And I'll take this from recently departed former England analyst Nathan Lehman, who said, I'm trying to remember the exact number, but he said that the first eight or nine players in a cricket team basically pick themselves almost all the time. And I having done a little bit of selection at the amateur level, at the professional level, at the international level, he's kind of right, right? You generally know your best eight to nine players almost automatically for most surfaces, most times. But most conversations when it comes to selection and when it comes to the media are about the 10th and 11th best players, right? And that's a quirk of our game because, again, it comes back to substitution. If your 10th best player comes in and you've picked the wrong player and you can't make a substitution, they're going to bowl for a couple of days. They've already failed in the first innings and they most likely are not going to be able to help you in the second innings. These are the things that happen within cricket. So it's a very different sport from that perspective. And, you know, I don't know what is taught to young players. I've never really worked with younger players coming through when it comes to how the media works. And a lot of people don't really understand cricket media all that well. Danny Rubin at the ECB should be one that was. He's one of the best press officers I've ever come across. And, you know, I've had a lot of issues with a lot of press officers. I don't think I've ever had an issue with Danny. I'm sure sometimes I've annoyed him. But even when I've annoyed him, he's never made out that I've annoyed him. Whereas with some of the other press officers, it was quite clear, you know, quite loud at times. And also, quite often, they're wrong in what they say back to you. Danny's very good at that. But I do wonder what we teach young cricketers. And if there's anything that you kind of learn from the Ben Stokes thing, again, it's I think they need to understand how the cycle works. They're not wrong to want it to be better, because I think that's also fair. But things are a little bit different. All right, I'll take a quick break. There's just a couple of questions in the room. And it is, all things considered, a short podcast by our standards. Don't tell Bayram I said this, but just saying, when Bayram's not here.
If you need a VPN, go Nord. Use nordvpn.com/Kimber to get a 2-year contract with a discount, plus 4 extra months, plus gifts in some markets. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the show notes. Protect your computer like a blocker protects the stumps with NordVPN today.
Mark says, Jared, you are the go-to guy for cricket, but my friend, it's time for a bit of humble pie with regards to RCB. I really want to take this question because I reckon I've said about 8 or 9 times I was wrong about RCB. And I'm not having to go at Mark here, but it's one of those things that kind of goes back to what I was talking about before. It's actually impossible to kind of take all of cricket media in at the moment, right? And I think I said once Hazelwood and Krunal Pandya started taking wickets that their team looked very different. I still kind of expected one of them to regress just because they're both taking more wickets than I would have expected. And then when Hazelwood went, I was like, well, they might be in trouble here. But other than that, like, I liked their batting coming in. I just didn't see how their bowling was going to work. And their bowling went above my expectations. Whereas there's a bunch of other teams that haven't. But like I talked about it on the podcast with Robbie the other day. We've talked about it on Cricket 8 bunches of times. I just did another Cricket 8 podcast with it before. Like, it's really hard to... this is another thing with modern sports media. So I will get the emails like what Mark has sent me here going, you never admitted that you were wrong about RCB. But also, right, I haven't probably done... I've probably mentioned I was wrong about RCB as many times as I've mentioned that I was right about Punjab, right? But some people will listen to one and some people will listen to the other. And this goes back to how players hear things as well, which is another reason I wanted to bring that up. Annika says, number three has been a difficult position to pad in for the past 5 years. There's no reasonable standards set to compare. Yeah, it's been a really tough era. As I said, I think Ollie Pope's whole numbers are depressed by the era that he has played in. Within that, you know, England did play in a summer with soft balls at one stage. Their pitches have not been as luminescent or, you know, their balls haven't swung as much as they used to. So it's hard to get that. But I think if you average 35 over a period of 6 years, like if it was 38 to 42, I'd be like, you're holding your own and that's okay. And especially with his age, I'd be like, I don't think that. But I think he's beneath that. And he's also specifically beneath that on key tours. I just had this up, actually. I didn't bring it up in the podcast, but I just want to see what his average was in England compared to everywhere else. So in England, he's averaging 40. Yeah, so home... Home is 40 and away is 30. So it's 35, but it's propped up. That 35 is then propped up. So when you, that's why when you're looking at things like this, you have to use the full system available to you. Someone contacted me about the art of batting, the other day, and was like, you know, going on and looking at the records of a couple of players and saying, you've got this player here, but look at this. And I was like, yeah, but you've looked at 5%, right? Of the stats and the information that we looked at for these two players. And you've looked at it for two players and we looked at it for 85. Like when you can go line by line with someone's record, I think 35 is fine, but he's not making runs away from home. And that's what I was trying to illustrate specifically with how he's gone in those sorts of places. But yeah, it's not easy because we do have to recalibrate our brain, which is why I was like, 35 is not terrible. There are lots of guys in modern cricket who've been doing worse than 35. I think that's fair to say. Keshav says, for what it's worth, do you think Stokes would have kept Pope ahead of Bethel against India had he failed against Zimbabwe? I don't know. I think that's a really good question, Keshav. I think they really back Pope. And as the vice captain and as a occasional captain and everything and the backup wicketkeeper, God, how many jobs do I want to give this one dude? That's the piece I would make about Ollie Pope, by the way. It's just like, I just think they've given him so many things to conquer. Anyway, I think that Pope would have played a little bit longer. I think they would have kept going. And Vivid says, why would England be against media putting pressure on their players' performances? So this is a New England. They really want this positive vibe type thing. And a lot of what Stokes and Duckett and some of the other players as well, but Ollie Robinson would be another one that comes to mind, have said publicly is really more for the change room. It's not for the fans or the press. So it's a very different way of doing it. And they're trying to keep this incredible vibe. But sometimes people don't make runs. And I always liked the idea that McCullum said, look, we understand that Crawley is not going to average 45 in test cricket, right? Or whatever. I can't remember how he phrased it. But he's going to have big impact when he does. And, you know, I'm going to be there with a cigar and some champagne every time, you know, he needs it, right? And so I kind of think from that point of that kind of side of things, it makes sense. But you also have to accept that the outsiders can't see it that way, right? When you have, I'm trying to think of a really good player from another team. But when you have a player from another team who you know is not like a top level player, but they're doing a role for within the team, which is what Crawley and Pope are both basically doing, right? If there was a better opener, he would be playing ahead of Crawley, right? If they thought they had someone who could average like 40, he'd just be in the side ahead of Crawley. If they thought they had another number three, Pope probably would have been dropped and would have been out of the side by now. But these are players playing roles and occasionally coming off. But you also have to accept that the outside's going to say what they say. So I would think it would be more to ignore it, right? And that's the weird thing about England. They talk about how they want to stay positive and everything. They don't read as much and whatever. And then you see something like this and you're like, well, isn't clearly you are following it. Sacco says, do you think eventually cricket should have substitution? I've talked about this a lot, and I think I've done a whole video and podcast on it before. I think it's dumb luck cricket doesn't have substitutions. I don't think it's like we decided not to have substitutions. I think football starts having them in the 1950s off the top of my head. We probably should have had substitutions at some stage between the 1930s and 1960s and 70s. We didn't. And then we made it like a USP, right? So now we don't have substitutions and other teams do. And so I get both sides of it. I think I've got this big piece that I've never quite finished about number 11s. And I love the fact that Mike Whitney has to face Richard Hadley to save a test match. You know, I love that. But I also understand that injuries cause huge problems in cricket. That if you get your selection wrong, and I'm not even saying, I don't mean get your selection wrong as in you pick the wrong players, but as in the conditions turned out to be different because you can't read the strip of grass because that's quite a random thing to do, then the game can be ruined, right? That if you lose the toss and you have the wrong team, the game can be ruined. There's a big argument, I think, that cricket would be a better sport, right, with substitutions. The flip side of that is that cricket would be a different sport with substitutions. And I can completely understand why we haven't gone there. I think the main reason we don't have substitutions right now, outside of the impact sub and the X factor and all those sorts of little sub super subs and the little things we've tried, honestly, is money. They don't want to make bigger squads. But I do think eventually we will probably get there. I think that's definitely where we're going. I'll do one more here from Carol Jimba. What are your views on the non-striker run out? The man cat, shouldn't they make it clear like other dismissals? It is absolutely clear. They have a line on the ground. If you don't want to be run out, keep your bat behind the line. Could not be more clear. Mojo says, why is Catalyst's greatness not talked about more? Am I living under a rock? You know, so he's obviously in the book. Trying to remember where he is. I should know all these. I should just print it out so I've got it. But he's obviously quite high up in the list. So we've got him as the 10th best test batter of all time. He was a stylish player, but not the most stylish of his era. He played in a bubble. He played very much for himself. So I think there's some elements of all those things playing a part. South African at a time when maybe the media, I mean, it's just always been the case, but England, India, Australia players are probably elevated a little bit more. But it's funny because we always talk about why is his greatness not talked about a lot. It's always talked about. He's always on the list of the most underrated players. Ponting came out the other day and said he might be one of the best cricketers of all time. Like, I don't feel like it's never talked about. He doesn't have great cheerleading. He's played some of the best innings I've ever seen. And I've talked about that before. I talk about it in the book. But he also played one of the stupidest innings of all time, which was when he was playing against Bangladesh and the opening partnership was 400 and he came in second drop and made 40 not out off 120 balls. Like, his inability to adapt to innings is very different than some of the other great batters of all time. And you have to factor all those things in. But obviously, absolutely a fantastic player. One of the greatest players of all time. Certainly in red ball cricket. White ball cricket's a little bit more complicated, isn't it? Someone picked him in their all-time 11 recently in somewhere in one of the white ball ones. I thought that was more interesting. I think there's definitely conversations that you can have about that. Like, I would, even if it was just a short career, I think Lance Clues' career is probably a better white ball career, but it's not as long. And Callis certainly had longevity and everything else. Anyway, that's all we have time for. I pop in a little podcast. I've been away and really busy recently. I haven't done as many of these podcasts when things come to my head, partly because we've been doing a lot of short videos. If you don't follow us on Instagram, and I think they go up on the YouTube Shorts as well, and they sometimes go up on Twitter and TikTok as well. If I just have something that comes to mind, and sometimes I have like 7 or 8 thoughts, I try and go over there and just sort of spit them out as quickly as I can. And this podcast, which might end up being a full video, comes from just having this brief thought of, oh, okay, that doesn't sound right. I want to talk about that. So if you want to follow us in those other places, please do. If not, subscribe and come back here. We've had the exit interviews go up, and we had 3 really cool videos about Zimbabwe last week that are worth going and checking out as well. Anyway, this is Good Areas Live. I'm Jared Kimber. We'll see you again next time. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.